Welcome to the Omfer podcast.
We have a fantastic discussion lined up. We are running a little later than we would be hoping, but these things happen. So we'll just be keeping everybody tight into time. So thank you very much. I can see that we already have Alex Mitchie on the line, who is head of Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero. Joining this panel will also be Marta Garcia, who is responsible banking sector manager for Banco Santander. So very good to see you, Marta. We have Angel Estrada, who is the Director General of Financial Stability Regulation and Resolution at Banco de España. So very good to see you there. I think we've seen you pop up and listening intently to the first session. So great to see you. And then Simon Thompson, Chief Executive of the Chartered Banker Institute. Simon, it's very good to have you here. I think the first session set up very well. The discussion that covered, actually, Simon and I were talking earlier this morning, and he said that if the discussion doesn't start or have data in it, there's no point in having one on climate. So data is extremely important, as is some of the suggestions for a carrot rather than the stick, and also the discussion on public-private partnerships. This second session, I really want to focus on the net zero and future of green finance. So kind of following on for those discussions, how can we embed the climate discussions into everything we do, and sustainability into every part of the banking and financial sector, rather than it being part of, but it being very much ingrained into. So first of all, I want to go to each participant, each member of the panel, and talking around the main steps being taken to assess resilience of companies and financial sector to the risks posed by climate change. How can this be globally aligned? There were a couple of questions coming in from the last panel that look to the pressure on business commitments and might not change behavior in company and banks, but what are the key public policies to be implemented? So I think that is also ingrained into this. How do we really achieve the financial sector to be taking steps to ensure that the risk posed by the climate change are mitigated against?
In response to your question, I think there's obviously a regulatory angle, like when central banks, prudential, macroprudential, microprudential authorities clearly have a role and a remit to ensure that financial stability risks are well managed. And we all know, and we've known for 6 years, I'd say, or more, that climate change, going back to the Tragedy of the Horizon speech that my boss gave at Lloyd's of London in 2015, is a financial stability risk. And I think central banks and other prudential supervisors and regulators around the world have really upped their game in recent years. And we, as the COP26 team, have been supporting them in that. You've got the Network for Greening the Financial System, which is obviously supporting global coordination to make sure things like climate stress testing are done in a coordinated way. I also think that the transition to net zero is an absolutely phenomenal opportunity, not just a risk. So, you know, there's $2 trillion a year investment opportunity. And there's, you know, autonomous research and various other pieces saying that there's actually a substantial uplift in it, in equities for those banks that are going to seize those opportunities. And how best to do that? I think actually joining an organization like the Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero and Net Zero and the Race to Zero, joining a really supportive peer group, working out how to actually do the implementation of the transition to net zero, which is a fiendishly complex and business-wide task, as I'm sure my colleagues on the panel like Santander will agree with, because I know they're working furiously within the Net Zero Banking Alliance to do that now.
How is Santander ensuring resilience to the risks posed by climate change?
For Santander, as the rest of the banks, key is to understand the resilience of the companies we lend to in order to understand the resilience of our own portfolio to climate change. And what are the main steps we are taking there? As Alex just mentioned, the first one I would highlight is we have set the ambition and we have a clear direction on where we want to go. We have the ambition to be net zero by 2050. We are a founding members of the Net Zero Banking Alliance, and we just in June released phase out strategies for thermal coal mining, thermal coal power, and also the first target for alignment of our power generation portfolio. So ambition is there. Second step, which I think it's also key, is we have a roadmap, of course, aligned with the Net Zero Banking Alliance, which makes things much easier, and also combining regulatory requirements, we have the main milestones we need to deliver in our commitments and in the regulator and supervisor scope, which is becoming intense in these recent years. And the third step is that we have agreed and are executing a four-pillar strategy to fight climate change. The first pillar is portfolio alignment. And here we are aligning, as I mentioned already, the power generation portfolio and other portfolios will come. The second is supporting our customers in a low carbon economy. The third pillar is reducing our own environmental impact. And here we are carbon neutral in our own operations since 2020. And finally, is embedding climate into risk management.
Angel, it would be very helpful to have your perspective from the Bank of España.
I think that the first step should be to have, as the previous speaker have said, to have a system of informational system that allow us to know where we are and how the things are evolving in the future. The second step is to develop the adequate analytical tools and methodologies in order to assess the potential impact of the risk, because as we know, we have not historical experience on this kind of process. So probably the tools should be prospective, for example, like a stress test, although we need to have in mind that at this moment, some of the physical risk and even transitional risk are starting to materialize. And the third step consists on incorporating those risks in the policy of the institutions. And this could imply, for example, to adjust the prices of the loans, of the financial products, in order to take into account this risk. In my view, this is very important in order to internalize, at least to some extent, the externality that pollution introduces in the economy, and also very important to identify the opportunities that are in the sector.
Thank you very much. Simon, please do offer your thoughts on the risks. And then just very quickly, I'm going to actually move on around the best practices around investing in green and driving green capital markets is the next question. So speakers, be prepared to think around that, a link to opportunities of green, I would say. But Simon, please focus on those risks and how companies are adjusting to them.
So let me focus on a different area, if I may, Ellie, and that is the capacity, the capability and the culture of financial institutions and the finance sector as a whole to support the COP26 private finance strategy, because this is a business-wide task in Alex's words. And I agree with him that it's bigger than the digital transformation. And let's remember, for many financial institutions, that's a transformation that is still ongoing. And I think bringing it to risk, without a culture of climate risk awareness throughout firms, indeed throughout financial services, then I'm afraid we'll see quite patchy identification and disclosure of climate risks, both within individual institutions and across finance as a whole. And there'll be particular issues in emerging markets where capacity and capability are particular constraints. So I think what we need to do globally then is to ensure that all finance professionals, both in the front line and in back office risk management roles, understand the cross-cutting, transverse nature of climate risks. So I think global alignment needs more than the harmonization of policy and regulation. It needs more than better data. It needs to be supported by ambitious action to build the capacity, the capability, and a climate-aware culture within financial institutions and across finance as a whole.
In financing what is green, main steps we have taken. We have a green finance target of 120 billion between now and 2025, and 220 billion by 2030. And as of June, we have already mobilized 42 billion euros in green finance. Leveraging also on the recently published EU taxonomy, we have developed and are implementing a sustainable finance classification system. This is a tool that would allow us to identify green volumes that are being granted to our customers and also support the development of the green activity at Banco Santander. And the third step is that we have identified five main lines of opportunities where we really see we can make the difference supporting our customers. And those opportunities are mainly in the sectors of green buildings, renewables, clean mobility, agriculture, and circular economy. We are really working on financing what is green, but on the other side, on supporting also our customers in the green transition. Two main ideas here. First is the unique position we believe the financial sector has, given our capillarity, to reach the real economy. We have examples in Spain, for example, during the pandemic, where we collaborate by granting loans from the Instituto del Crédito Oficial, and we are able to reach 91% of the Spanish population. This is key for helping countries such as Spain to transition and, for example, collaborating in disbursing the EU recovery funds, which will have also a climate component. It is also very important that banks are allowed to support customers and try not to leave anyone behind. So it is great. And of course, we are to finance what is green, but we also need to be mindful of not leaving anyone behind in this transition. We need everyone to be on board to really achieve the climate goals.
Thank you. Alex, I want to come to you and also ask this, what you've seen as being kind of the best practice and also around what businesses are doing within financial institutions can employ to assess companies' transitions as well. So I want also if you can kind of come in around what you're looking at to ensure that there's kind of no greenwashing in these conversations.
I completely agree with the points Marta made about what we need is a financial system that is supporting real economy transition. And that includes financing the whole economy to transition and decarbonize. So yes, financing green is incredibly important, but we also need to work out how to get finance to those firms, to those households, to those companies that need to manage and finance their own transition to net. And also the very much the philosophy of GFANS as an organization and alliance. And we've kicked off seven work streams to accelerate the transition to net zero, real world transition to net zero. And I'd say two of them are specifically on this point, like how can we best work with the real economy and corporates to facilitate and fund their own decarbonization. So the first is on sectoral pathways. So some of you might be familiar with the Poseidon principles. So like building on that work that was done with the shipping industry to set out decarbonization pathway and doing that collaboratively with the real economy to set net zero pathways for different sectors. And the other one, which is very relevant here, is setting out in a clear way expectations around what we as a financial community expect to see in corporate transition strategies so we can better assess which companies are committed to transition and have really credible transition strategies.
Angel, it would be very helpful for you to come in with what are the regulators doing? What are the central banks doing? Any insights from the NGFS as well on allowing for the incentives to go green, but also what are the best practices that you've seen?
With respect to the potential regulatory measures, the complexity is very high. It's very high because some of what Simon said before, because the climate risks can be captured through the traditional risks, credit risks, market risks, liquidity risks, operational risks. But the problem is that they have very specific elements that make them different. The first one is the longer horizon. Well, perhaps 1 year or 2 years ago, we thought that the horizon was longer, but I think that the horizon is diminishing. But one of the elements is the horizon. And the second one is that we have no historical experience on the materialization of this kind of risk. And this is very important, but because most of the regulation now lies on models that are based, empirical models that are based on experience.
And I want to go to Simon. I want to ask you this same question. If you can kind of keep it quick to see what you think in the industry is the best, perhaps the most effective way that you've seen. I know that we're talking quite a lot on capacity building, which was very helpful. And also, I'm going to ask each of you to give me a quick fire. If there was one thing that could come out of COP26, what would that be that you would laud as like the key driver to be actually to be able to achieve net zero by 2050?
In terms of best practice, I think a couple of areas that I would have highlighted, we have been mentioned earlier, particularly the growth in sustainability linked lending and bonds. We didn't mention the very welcome focus we're now seeing on transition finance. So supporting companies and communities moving to green rather than lending or investing to those companies and technologies that are green. But the great majority of lending isn't linked at the moment to sustainability targets or isn't green at all. Only some 3% of total bond issuance, even in the broadest definition, could be described as green. You know, most financial institutions are not part of global alliances, such as GFANZ or the PRB, for instance. So the question is actually, how do we move from best practice to standard practice? Because that's what we're trying to do here, isn't it? We're trying to align finance with sustainability. It's not about best practice. It's about this becoming standard practice. And the answer is set out, I think, in the COP26 private finance strategy. You know, what needs to change is the culture within finance so that every professional financial decision takes account of climate change. That is the objective set out in the COP26 private finance strategy. And for that to take place, it follows that every finance professional needs to have an understanding and awareness of these kinds of issues so that every finance professional is thinking about this all of the time in every conversation with customers and clients, when developing new products and services, when thinking about risk, and so on. So to align financial capital with sustainability and move from best practice to standard practice, we also need, or perhaps even first need, to align human capital with sustainability too. And I don't think that's getting enough attention. So one thing I'd like to see in terms of green finance at COP26 then is for us to be as collectively ambitious in terms of building the capacity and capability of finance and professional services to support the transition as we are in setting the decarbonisation targets themselves. Otherwise, we're not going to meet them.
I really like that moving best practice to standard practice line. So fully agree there. I think that's the ambition. Once we actually stop having these conversations and that green finance is just part of everything we do, or we have them in a different way, I think will be achieved.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, people who talk about green finance like me should be made redundant because we should be talking about finance, not green finance.
Great. So hopefully in 2050, you'll be able to retire there, Simon.
If I haven't retired by 2050, something has gone badly wrong.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much. So, Alex, the one thing to come out of COP, we're going to keep it quick because I do really want to go to the ambassador.
Well, the highest level goal is to keep 1.5 degrees alive of COP26, and that's going to need increased ambition from governments, frankly, better NDCs and the like, because if we don't keep 1.5 degrees alive, we're in trouble as a planet. So
there we go. Thank you.
That's a top level goal. One of the four priorities of that is finance, and that's why Mark Carney's leading Private Finance Hub, and I think Simon just channeled Mark Carney in everything he said. The outcome needs to be that every professional financial decision takes climate into account, and that's not ESG, that's mainstreaming everything we're doing, and that's what GFANZ is about, bringing together not just banks but asset managers, asset owners, insurers, stock exchanges, credit rating agencies and the like to all work together to ensure that every professional financial decision takes climate into account.
I'm being very, very generous, liberal with my time, but Marta, very quickly.
Thank you. Very quick. I would highlight three messages from a financial entity point of view. First, clear direction. Governments should set clear pathways, especially for the most concerning sectors, how they are going to reach the low carbon economy. And this will add certainty. Second, adequate incentives. So companies need to have incentives to transition, and the financial sector needs to have incentives to support the transition. and this will help in speed achieving the goals. And third, global homogeneity in regulation and data. If not, decisions cannot be made accurate. So this will be key to ensure a level playing field and to reach transparency in the market.
Thank you. Angel, your what do you see on, what do you see at COP26?
Yeah, in my view, the two elements that are more important in this respect are very similar to the ones that were raised by my predecessor, José María Roldán, related to the we need to show and you need from in this respect the world level. And in this respect, I think that it's more important to have an agreement than other considerations. Because as I said before, I think it's very important to show the world that there is no free riding in this respect. And the second very important element in my respect is to take into account that most of the measures, the most powerful measures that we can implement in order to facilitate the transition are not in the hands of the financial sector or the central banks or the regulators, probably are the governments. But it's very important to take into account that some of these measures can have important effects in inequality. And it's, in my view, it's very important not to leave behind anybody, because we need the social support in order to achieve those targets. We cannot repeat the, let's say, mistakes that we have, for example, with globalization.
Thank you very much. And thank you all. I think we could have a whole other session on ensuring equality across sustainability and transition to net zero. But we won't. Don't worry, Ambassador. We are closing now. And thank you all for joining us. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And I think it's been an enlightening conversation that has sparked more conversation. So again, thank you very much to the embassy in Spain and to the Chamber of Commerce. So thank you. And I now hand over to Ambassador Hugh Elliott, who is the British ambassador to Spain and Andorra. And thank you on behalf of OMFIF as well. It's been a delight to work with you. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Ellie. And thank you to everybody. And an incredibly rich discussion, which I have listened to throughout. And my brain hurts, I'm afraid, right now, as I try to digest it all and think of an appropriate way of wrapping up. So what I think I'll do is, first of all, I'll start by saying thank you. So thank you very much to everybody who's participated. Thank you, Ellie. Thank you, Danae. Thank you, Romfrey, for helping. You've been great partners through all of this. Thanks, of course, to Gonzalo, to Emma, the Lord Mayor, to everybody who's made this such a rich and interesting discussion. Of course, Eduardo, Spanish Chamber, we've got a fantastic relationship. Might come back to something. So I would just, I think, probably share a few quick personal reflections on some of the things that I've said. I used to work in communications, and so I like strap lines. And I think the best strap line I got from all of this was, is not really a strap line, but it was what José María said in, one of your extremely interesting comments, José María, which was, this is complicated. And it is very complicated. I think you were referring particularly to international collaboration, which you have all identified as being absolutely central. Marta just mentioned that, in terms of, you know, global homogeneity of regulation, obviously an extraordinarily complicated thing to achieve, but something that we are definitely fully working on as governments around the world. So how do you make sense of this complexity? The next strapline I thought was another one from José María, which was the Apostles to Plumbers, the strapline, which I thought summarizes quite a lot. I think it's great that if we don't need apostles anymore, they go into the background and there's less preaching and more wiring being like a mix of my professions. So I think it is very, very good if we're actually moving to those discussions and the encouragement to get public and private in the room to make those very real practical sort of discussions. I think really important. And looking to the complexity, we just need to make a lot more of this happen, a lot more of the time. That's really important. I was struck by the mention, which you mentioned in passing when we were looking at what's happening in Spain right now in electricity prices, at the question of public acceptability. And I do think this is an underplayed aspect of the debate at the moment, which is to be able to look ahead at what we think the actual public and citizens feel from what they see around what's happening and how we keep the public acceptability on board throughout all of this. It's very well to say we would like to have green everything, but when green everything starts to get money, green everything becomes slightly less attractive. I think that is a risk which is quite underplayed, and it would be good in this area to look at a bit more. The question of moving from, and I think Simon, this was your comment, from best practice to standard practice, I completely and very strongly agree with that, and it's something that, sort of having, you know, worked on sustainability agendas in private and public sectors, I feel about quite strongly. I personally hate the term environmental and social governance, and to nick your idea and transfer it, Simon, I would say, why is ESG not just G? That would be my strap line on a lot of it. And then, really, to say, just by way of closing, that, of course, from the position of the UK government, I'm not going to give you a spiel about the UK government's position and the initiatives. You've heard a lot about a lot of different initiatives throughout an aspect of the UK government and other UK actors' ambitions throughout this discussion. Just to say that it is great that there is a massive political consensus around many of the principles in the UK. And I should say, by the way, that it's been an interesting discussion for another reason, which is because my boss has changed during the discussion, because there has been a cabinet reshuffle going on in the United Kingdom, and the Foreign Secretary is now Liz Truss, who I'm very pleased to say is, like her predecessor, a strong advocate of rapid climate action, and one who understands the implications for the importance of the public, which is great news. The fact that we're facilitators here, really, as the embassy, because it is such an important issue for our two countries, I think the relationship between the UK and Spain is, to take another strap line from the quote, thank you very much, Eduardo, the best since Wellington. There were scratchy times around Wellington's time, so I think it may be even better. But I'll take the best of Wellington. And that does mean we're in a reasonably good place to facilitate some of these kinds of discussions. Appreciate very much the synergies, the investment link that Rami, and that it just made perfect sense for us. And we absolutely will. It's a core part of what we're up to as an embassy, as a diplomatic network around the world. It will continue to be that. COP26, coming on the back of COP25, as you all know, obviously strengthens that link. But it's not just about a climate summit, because we need to be turning our minds to after COP26 and how we continue to keep the momentum going once we have banked a lot of the successes that I hope we will manage to bank in COP26. And it is being a massive international effort. You've talked about, I think somebody mentioned there were 32 working days to go, and somebody else mentioned there were sort of 50 calendar days. I haven't been counting myself, but I suspect there's no actual difference between calendar days and working days for many of those people working on COP 26. And I take my hat off to them. And I just wanted to finish up by saying that the role of green finance in all of this, the more I participate in these events and the more I learn about it, the more central it is. And so I am very grateful to all of you for giving your time to this debate, and for doing all that you are doing. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the OMFIF podcast.